Music Learning Conversation podcast. Brought to you by You Can Play.
Welcome to the Music Learning Conversation podcast. My name's Jonathan Savage.
My name's Andy Scott.
And you are very welcome. Today's special guest is Alice Chesterman. She is the head of creative learning at Digit Music. Welcome, Alice.
Hi there, lovely to see you both.
Thanks so much for coming along. My business, You Can Play, we've been working with Digit Music on their new musical instrument, which is called Composer. Here it is here. It's a joystick instrument. It's an amazing interface. Allows you to play melodies and chords and rhythms using the joystick and the various buttons. And we're going to be hearing a little bit more about this instrument later on in the podcast. But Andy, it got me thinking about music technology and instruments. And I know with your saxophone playing and your composition work that you've been using Roland's new Aerophone. And I wondered if you had any thoughts on that and how you've been getting on with it.
Yeah, it was really interesting because I'm someone who's played the saxophone for 40 years, and to suddenly be presented with an instrument that's, you know, you can tie in with technology. And it's so well designed. So as a saxophonist, you can move over to it pretty much straight away. But then it opens up a whole new world with sounds and possibilities. I must admit, though, you know, this was, I can't remember when this was, maybe a year and a half ago. And I just found more recently, it's such a struggle, though, for someone like me who spends a lot of time writing commissions and playing the saxophone, then to really devote the time to the Aerophone. But I know some people who are, you know, it's been an absolutely perfect match. But having said that, it came in really handy in lockdown because I was approached by Liverpool Museums and they wanted a 25-minute soundscape commission for an exhibition that was running from last May to the end of August. And they wanted some music, so we composed the music and we recorded some strings in a nice studio in Manchester and trumpet. And then I used the Aerophone because it was all based around Tudor music. That was the theme. So some of the kind of recorder sounds, I put those down in the studio on Aerophone. So it came in very, very handy very soon after actually getting hold of it and playing it a little bit.
Fantastic. And I think we're going to hear a little bit of that now. Fantastic. And that really was a family composition, wasn't it, Andy? Because there were other people in your family playing along.
Yeah, and what was really lovely about it was Fiona, who is in charge of the Liverpool Museums. My son, a bit like Josh here, is into production, music producing and plays, had been through the pop music course at the Royal Northern College in Manchester, and then lockdown hit. And Fiona appreciated that the young musicians who just graduated were coming out to a business that had been decimated and there was no work there. And she was very keen to bring in a young musician like Stan and bring in his production electronics into the kind of mix. So that little example was very pastiche in a way, and it's played very, very quietly when people walk around and looking at the pictures of Henry VIII. But there's, towards the end of the exhibition, Fiona said, well, let's have 5 minutes of music where Stan takes what we've got already with the strings and the harp and the Aerophone, but then it becomes more experimental, more ambient, so he could sort of do his thing with the electronics and production and, you know, use his imagination and creativity. And so basically it gave him some paid work and, it, you know, sort of his mind was allowed to be creative during that time, thanks to Fiona's imagination, really. So it was a lovely project.
That sounds great. Well, and it relates very much to the discussion that I was having with Digit Music's Simon and Owen last week about the composer, because we were saying in relation to this instrument how, yes, you could use it to replicate and engage with sounds that are, you know, well known, pianos or guitars or whatever. But actually, there might be a whole new form of music that children in schools could begin to experiment with this instrument, and other places, of course, as well. So an interesting...
Yeah, I think it's very, very exciting times, because technology is a massive plus. And for young people growing up with it, where it's just natural to them in terms of using it, their facility is incredible. So if the developer in the music world mirrors that, it can only be a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we've got two work experience students with us this week who you can't see, but they're sitting over there, Ellis and Arena. And one of their jobs tomorrow, Alice, is to learn how to play this instrument. So I'll be looking forward to seeing how they get on.
I can't wait to see how they get on with it.
Yeah, well, it's time to welcome you properly, Alice, and thanks again for coming on. But Alice is the current head of creative learning at Digit Music. Digit Music's mission is to remove barriers to music through innovation and easy-to-use technology, supporting musicians of all abilities and disabilities to develop themselves personally and professionally. But prior to working at Digit Music, Alice was the creative learning manager with a focus on schools at London's South Bank Centre. She's focused on devising and producing cultural projects that encompass creative learning opportunities and participation across art forms. And she specialises in building new creative programmes that can enrich the cultural and, I think I can say, educational sectors as well, by linking together artists and organisations with participants and audiences and young people, of course. So, Alice, once again, very warm welcome to our podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Your title is Head of Creative Learning at Digit Music. Perhaps you could just tell us a bit about Digit Music, first of all, and what the Head of Creative Learning does.
Sure. So Digit is a wonderful company in that we do a lot of things. We're all sort of music professionals, people who've worked in education and creative learning for a long time. What we've done, myself, Owen and Si coming together, is bring a whole host of experiences within different areas of the industry together. So Digit has a commercial facing arm. So we have a sample label, Digit Sounds, where we create the sort of building blocks of music. So those people who don't know what a sample pack is, it's all those elements of beats, loops, but maybe vocals or samples of different sounds from different genres that music producers can use in their work. So that's one side. And those will get sold on Loopmasters and Splice and places like that. But then also that area of our work, we create music for TV, film and specific commissions. In the middle, obviously, you've already introduced Composer, which is the first of our instruments, which we are delighted it's hitting the market this year. But it's a product that's got such a history. You know, I've been following the development of Si's work with Inspire Youth Arts and the Able Orchestra, where Composer really was born, since about 2014 when I was working at South Bank Centre. So it was meeting there that I've sort of been following the journey of this instrument and the ones that will be to come as well. And then the creative learning side of that, I joined Digit last year, is really looking at, especially right now with music education and the new plan for music education, there's a big drive for music companies, education companies to help connect young people, not just to nice music offers, but to that through path to professional careers, to opportunities to work in the industry. So what I wanted to create at Digit when I joined with Si and Owen was to look at all the things that we can offer as an organisation. What can we offer young people? What can we offer teachers that's authentic to what we do to help enrich their work, to give more opportunities for people to engage in a first point music opportunity, but then also how do we help them progress? So not just about us as a company, but across the wider sector, where's our responsibility in helping those young people and those teachers, those adults that we might encounter, maybe young adults out in the community working in disability sectors, to find the next step for them. So whatever point somebody's on at their journey, that we're facilitating that. But I guess with Digit's creative learning arm, we have in the last year developed a creative learning program called Global Sound Culture, which is a kind of a really exciting blend of all the things that we do best. So we partnering up with music studios from around the world once a year. So this year we've been working with Supersonic Africa out in Nairobi to sample, professionally sample, really authentic, beautiful sounds from that region. And then to bring those sounds into a sample pack, which will be out for commercial sale. But we've also created alongside it the first of our education resources, which has kind of step-by-step walkthroughs for teachers to help them delve into music technology in a friendly and accessible way. It enables them to use some of the old tech that's sitting in their cupboard, maybe disused, old iPads, maybe the front room computer, if that's all the resource that they have. But then also for those teachers that have the access to more interesting technology and maybe instruments such as composer or MIDI keyboards, or there's loads of great instruments out there, that pack translates across all of that as well. So that's one arm. And we've also been lucky enough to secure some funding with Youth Music. So we've got a youth board as well. Quite a lot of work going on across sort of Mansfield, Manchester, Nottingham, where we're talking to young people who've been traditionally locked out of music opportunities. Actually, they still are, most of them, not able to access it. So our creative learning work is about a lot of listening, really, to the sector, to young people, to teachers, about what they need, and then our programme meeting them where they're at, we hope.
Oh, that sounds fascinating. And I think I'm right in saying that some of those African sounds that you've been recording are going to be made available for the composer instrument at some point.
Yes, they will. They will. So anyone purchasing it will get sound bundles. And, you know, there'll be sort of freebies each month for people who've signed up through the portal as well. So there's some honestly beautiful sounds that I've come across. And that pack that goes into schools has interviews with all of the musicians. So what's beautiful is if you're a child in the classroom, wherever you are in the UK, you can watch that musician sat playing their Nyatiti or their Urutu instrument and understand where it's come from tribally, from their areas in East Africa. And then they can very quickly pick up an instrument and play it, you know, via technology, which is what's so exciting
about
it.
That sounds awesome. That sounds amazing. Well, thank you very much for telling us a bit about your role at Digit Music. And you used the word in your answer, which I think is central to so much of your work at the moment and maybe previously as well in the South Bank Centre. And that word is partnership. And partnership working is kind of a core part of our business for sure. And it's something that people talk about a lot. And it's become, a very central way in which schools and other businesses and charities and companies can work together. But just within your experience of working at the South Bank Centre and then more recently, can you tell us a bit about what makes for a successful educational and arts partnership?
Oh, essentially listening. It's you know, it's a big part. We wrote some values last year when I joined Digit. And a big thing that we all agreed on was that we have to listen. I think, you know, I've worked with a huge number of organisations and bringing them together collectively to do projects at South Bank, for example. But having a kind of an understanding of where everyone's coming from, why they're doing the things that they're doing, what they need, what they'd like to learn from each other, having that at the start of a partnership so that you're going on a journey together. And that doesn't matter whether that's a collective of five schools or whether that's five orchestras and six choirs and two schools thrown into the mix. If we all understand that there's no leader, particularly in a partnership, it's about going on a journey together and learning from each other whilst you have that partnership. I mean, I was on a call just yesterday with a Music Mark conference, which was a talk between music technologists, but there were a lot of hub leaders in there, responding to a survey about what's needed right now in schools, what equipment do they have, rather than us presuming. Having those conversations and working together to think about what are the actual best ways of solving things, or what can we offer teachers in a way that works for their curriculum? Because there is so much pressure, particularly on school teachers at the moment, lack of time, lack of resources. And it's all very well and good coming up with lovely ideas, but unless you're really talking to the leaders of this practical work day to day, it won't get used. So for me, partnership wise, it's absolutely essential that we're listening to each other.
Yeah, I can agree with that entirely. And just reflecting on some of the conversations around the National Plan for Music Education, from our point of view, I know that one of the things that impressed me a lot was the work that you've been doing around inclusion and making sure that children, you know, of all abilities and disabilities can access music through different types of musical instruments. And I think there's a lot of potential in your composer for that. But we'll maybe come on to that later on. I think Andy's going to have a chat with you now about some questions around creative learning.
Yeah, I know we've got sort of, you know, some questions, pre-planned questions and everything, but it was just intriguing hearing you talk them, because it just got me thinking about the music teachers in schools. Mm-hmm. And as you said, it's the actual practicalities, isn't it? Their time is so limited. So in terms of sort of creative learning then, what does this mean in practice in terms of how will things differ for music teachers that you, how do you see it in terms of the technology you're providing after these, after some dialogue?
Well, I think, you know, this is an area of work that fascinates me. I don't know if people have sort of read and listened to Ken Robinson's discussions around education and creativity, but I'm a huge fan of his work. There's been a huge drop in the importance of creativity in schools, through the schools. And I want to put a caveat at the beginning that this is not, I feel like I generalize when we talk about these statistics. There are amazing teachers out there everywhere doing incredible work, and many schools are doing fantastically. There are also extraordinary teachers who are trying to keep that work alive, but there has been a system that is causing pressure on their ability to give time over to creativity. So, you know, lots of bits of work around things like the Durham report, for example, a few years back, looked at the importance of creativity for children's development personally and professionally. You know, we use that in our statement. But when we talk about education, it's very much about learning a set curriculum, learning, memorizing facts, memorizing ideas around things. And there will always be creativity around that. That's why teachers are incredible, because they bring together that bringing alive an imagination of education. But particularly moving into secondary, there's a real push for tests and statistics and children having set knowledge and being very right or wrong on things. And I think with creativity, it's a very different approach, and creative learning. It's about giving a child a space, a child, a young person, an adult, wherever they're at, space to learn the skills around problem solving, critical thinking, to build a curious mindset. You know, I think there's lots in there, but if you don't allow a child to play and get things wrong, and the things wrong is, I think, essential. You know, we end up with less rounded students. And actually, I've talked a lot with teachers about students' mental health, their well-being, the amount of worry that they carry about getting things wrong all the time, because they're not given that space within their school and their learning to play and experiment and to get things wrong and to try again and to create and discuss with each other. And it's that mindset of playfulness.
So I'm interested. So as a you know, freelance musician, I'm interested in if you had an opportunity, if you had a magic wand and could just change things, where's this problem go back to? Why are the teachers put up? We know they're put under pressure, and we've got this thing of, you know, music is subjective. It's not just a right or wrong, and not being afraid of making mistakes and when you're being creative. How could that be changed? I know it's a really broad question, but just for a moment, if you could almost forget the practicalities, where would it go back to change all this?
Gosh, I feel like there's so many elements that sit across this. Teachers aren't given very much training around it. If you look at the kind of teacher training program, sometimes there's like a half day on poetry or a half day on how to do a creative response in art or something. You know, that there's not much time and space for teachers to have creative space. I mean, I used to run a series at Southbank Centre where we had sort of creative teachers evenings. So we do kind of introductions to gallery spaces. We get them to talk about play and practice and have them have space to share their ideas. So we used to do a teacher feature, for example. One teacher would stand up and say, I've done this great project this week and I did it with my students in this way. And you'd see so many of the teachers sort of reawaken and connect with their creative selves as well. And I think the systems that they're put into, they are marking a lot of the time. They are under pressure to hit Ofsted. They're under pressure because there's no budget. They're facing huge, you know, particularly post-COVID, problems in the classroom with young people who need additional support, sometimes language barriers. There's a whole melting pot of pressures that they have to answer to. So, you know, there is the top-down thing of support, time and budget that helps, which doesn't sound like creativity, but it enables it. So yeah, and I think also the other thing is, you know, going back to the Durham report, there was, I've forgotten the name of who it was, but somebody from a very large science organisation was talking about the kind of student candidates that they were having coming through, being frightened to try new ideas, being frightened to be creative, and that they're missing that from the sector. So, you know, if we can look at government and things like EBAC, which, you know, since 2010, there's been a 27% drop in GCSE music take-up. And it's not a coincidence. We're making less value for those kind of creative arts in the learning space. Speaking to a teacher just yesterday, you know, his extracurricular music activities are being cut down and replaced with revision sessions on the main subjects. So the kind of the scope of what young people are being able to focus on in school and the pressure on teachers, those things aren't creative environments. You know, you don't have a creatively flourishing mind when you have concerns about exam outputs and restraints on everything. It's, you know, it's a big magic wand, but it's about time, space and money, really. And yes. A lot of time.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, I don't know. In one of my previous jobs, I had the pleasure of visiting schools across the northwest of England, and I would visit regularly 30 or 40 secondary schools and a large number of primary schools as well. And it was always interesting to reflect a little bit about how teachers in primary schools approached the teaching of different areas of the curriculum compared to the very sort of siloed kind of divisions of subjects in the secondary school. Curriculum. And whilst I don't think that primary schools have the preserve on teaching creatively, I certainly was able to see primary school teachers joining up ideas and joining up different subjects in a way that secondary school teachers weren't able to do. And I think one of the ways in which we can challenge the status quo into, or even the way that the curriculum is managed in schools, both primary and secondary, is to work through partnerships, because as you know, the values and the aspirations of a charity or a learning organisation like the South Bank or a company like Digit Music may well be different to the values and aspirations of, you know, any given school in any given place. And having those conversations with teachers is crucial, isn't it, in terms of developing practice in new directions, whether that be your practice as a teacher or your practice as a musician.
We had a lovely project at the South Bank Centre where we partnered teachers with artists. It was a week-long residential. It was a new programme that happened pre-COVID, so I'm not quite sure where it's at the moment. But that ethos has always been there at the South Bank, you know, bringing teachers back into that creative space alongside artists. There's no programme that a teacher could go on and sit down in front of a whiteboard that will give them more than working next to somebody whose practice is expansive and, you know, hasn't had boundaries on it. This is the thing. Just learn to play again. I think that's play is a word that comes up a lot. We had a tutor training day the other day and all of us came back to this idea of playfulness.
Yes.
Being flexible. And, you know, it's very hard for teachers to do that. And actually the teachers that we worked with on that program all got very emotional when they got back in touch with the idea of why did I become a teacher? Or when did I stop dancing? When did I stop playing on my piano? Or why do I not use that bit of myself when I'm in the classroom? You know, I think that's some really big questions in there. But again, it's, I feel like we have a big responsibility to support teachers right now, because it's hard, really, really hard. And we're not paying them enough, for one, but we're not looking after them either.
No, I agree with that. And one of our previous episodes was with a gentleman called Robbie Gardner, who runs the teacher training program as part of the Royal Northern College of Music and Manchester Metropolitan University. And he was making exactly the same point, actually, that certainly, you know, to be a successful music teacher, he was talking about secondary schools, how it's so crucial that you build on your own musicality as a musician.
I mean, that's a bit of a rule that we have about our tutor team. So we've recently employed some amazing tutors that we've got across Manchester and Derbyshire. All of them are practicing musicians. All of them are out there playing, creating, making in the community. And I think bringing that energy, I mean, that's what we talk about with our sort of CPD and training and workshops, is bringing that voice back into the classroom. Often, you know, yes, it will inspire lots of young people. We hope as well it will just remind teachers about that voice of what's going on out there being broader than just the syllabus.
Fantastic.
Do you mind if I ask you a question that isn't scripted, but is based on what we were chatting before we started recording? With you playing flute and saxophone.
Very badly, but yes.
No. It's great you do. It might sound like a really naive question, but how does it make you feel when you've got your job, you're doing what you do, family, life. When you pick up the flute or the saxophone, how does it make you feel?
Do you know what? It feels like giving myself space again. To be me, because you know, as we were talking about earlier, I've sort of returned to tinkering on the piano or picking up my flute because I've suddenly realised my children see me on my computer all the time. Mummy's work at the top of the house is this box, which is never, you know, I think when I was working at South Bank Centre, it was a building that they could come to and they would see orchestras left, right and centre and amazing. But actually to demonstrate some of what we do in front of our children is important. But by doing that, you go, oh, this brings me real happiness and there's a freedom in this. And, you know, actually I did it the other lunchtime. I stopped and went and practiced a little piece on piano because my daughter's got really into singing it with me. But oh, actually brilliant. Sitting down and playing for half an hour, I went back to my desk feeling like I'd shaken off a lot of worries. My mental health felt more balanced. You know, it really helps. I really do believe that's as good as going for a swim, just sitting down and playing a piece.
Yeah, I think the whole breathing element as well with something like the flute or saxophone. That's why I think, you know, just even long notes, just playing long notes for 5 minutes can just clear your head.
Absolutely, yeah.
No, thank you for that. Sorry, that was just throwing one at you.
That's lovely. I should just say that we're talking about the composer today, which is Digit Music's new instrument, not because they've asked us to, but because we've bought this instrument and we want to learn more about it. And I think it has some tremendous potential. So, Alice, just tell us a little bit about the genesis of this new instrument to finish our interview and what you're hoping to achieve with it.
So composer, as you sort of already mentioned, it's a joystick based controller with 8 buttons on it as well. The kind of origins of it are that we've talked a little bit, I think maybe we haven't today actually, about the Able Orchestra project that we work with Inspire Youth Arts in Nottingham. And we saw something there. This was Cy back in the day, not me, but I was observing from the South Bank Centre. That a lot of young people, in particularly with additional needs in schools, they weren't, again, teachers, not through any fault of their own, because they haven't had the training and the opportunity, their aspirations for those students musically weren't very high. And Inspire set up this fantastic project, which was originally the iPad Orchestra, which then has grown into the Able Orchestra, which, you know, fantastically has more funding from the Arts Council this year. And it was about bringing young people and professional musicians together. And what Cy noticed one day was that, you know, young people with upper limb differences, often iPads are still really difficult, touchscreens. But yet a young person's whizzing around driving a wheelchair like an absolute demon. There's muscle memory there. There's learned behaviour there. We also know that there's a whole generation and group of people out there who game. And their reactions with a thumb muscle are intensely good. You know, you look at all the kind of Nintendo Switch kind of base things, that people's thumbs are very strong these days. But the joystick came out of, if you flip the composer that way, it will remind you it's very similar to a wheelchair controller. But actually, once it had been developed, what we've known is lots of young people who don't. We're talking mainstream young people. We've worked with Improves. We've done lots of outreach projects with different groups. They are finding it much more friendly as an instrument. So for young people who might have grown up without any access to music, without any access to classical music, maybe they're beat makers in their bedrooms, maybe they're spitting bars on their phones and recording it and sharing it with their mates. This feels much more friendly to them. So it's bringing young people a kind of a choice. And I think with any instrument of any ilk, it's a choice. But the great thing with composer is, as you said at the beginning, it can be a harp, it can be a guitar. If there's a young person that's always wanted to play piano but only has one hand or less dexterity, they're able to play. And it gives that opportunity, which I think is incredible. But the other thing about it is there's infinite progression. So as well as this being a piece for schools, it's going into studios, it's going into live performance. We've seen a couple of these controllers go into the Power Orchestra for an R&D piece in the last few months, which is really exciting. But we're also seeing it used on backlines, on big gigs as well. So it kind of, what I love about it is that it removes that boxing of this instrument is for this group of people. It's not. It's an instrument. And it's as adaptable as the person that comes to it. It's a bit like a piece of artwork. You bring your own experience to it and use it in the way that you see. It's a playful, creative tool. And in terms of for schools, there's endless options with it. You know, you can plug it into a digital audio workstation with a group of GCSE students. For a student who's less confident with notation, they can get building their beats really quickly. They can play instruments that they've not done their 100 hours on. You know, they're able to be expressive with it and play beautifully and record that. It also means that young people with additional needs or disabilities are able to play in ensembles. So the ABLE Orchestra is all about that integration of able-bodied and non-able-bodied players being together and being on equal terms, which is wonderful. And the workshops that we do also mean that if there's a set of these going out, you've instantly got maybe a drill group, or we can plug into an electronic sound scrape, or we can visit Africa, for example, like bring in those sounds from East Africa. So it's got really exciting opportunities, I think. And this year, we're just really excited to see where it goes. We're shipping them out sort of left, right and centre this week. And it's the beginning of an exciting journey, I think.
Yeah, well, we're delighted to be able to explore this instrument. I think it has some fantastic potential. And say, we only got ours on Friday. So we're at the very early stages of exploring it. But I know that you've spent a huge amount of time and effort to make sure that it's presented well to education. And I know there are some, I've seen some of the educational materials around learning to use it, and you've developed your own notation systems and various other things, which I think teachers are going to really appreciate, because unlike so many other technology companies, you have really thought hard about how this instrument can be used within an educational setting. So congratulations on the launch, and thank you so much for spending time with us today on the Music Learning Conversation podcast. We've really enjoyed chatting with you, Alice.
Yeah, it's been brilliant. Thank you, Alice.
Thanks very much.
Okay, hope to see you soon. Thank you, Alice.
Thank you.
Regular listeners to our podcast know that we feature a new piece of music in each episode. This week's music comes from Andy Scott, and it's a piece of music that he composed called Mancunity. It's a multi-movement piece, and we're going to hear the final section, I believe, which is called Sound.
There we go. That was one movement from a piece I wrote, as Jonathan said, called Mancunity. That movement was called Sound. And the reason for playing that was thinking of Alice, really, and thinking about our interview prior to this and talking about technology and electronics. This was a commission from Manchester Jazz Festival and an opportunity to handpick the band, which, in fact, Josh played in, who's here, on percussion in that piece. And it gave me an opportunity to work with musicians of different backgrounds, different ages, different skills. And the example in that particular movement was I got together with Aaron Wood, who's the fantastic trumpet player on that track. And he works a lot with electronics. So he'll play his trumpet. And I met with him before I composed, and he said, well, I can do this. I've got these pedals, and he could create four note chords that had particular intervals and shapes. So I then wrote for that, and there were four other horn players in the horn section, so five with Aaron. And so we could have a dialogue. Aaron could play four note chords, and then I'd score the other four horns to react and mirror that and respond. So we got a kind of conversation going, and that was thanks to the electronics, thanks to the pedals during that. So yeah, it was it's a learning curve for me as a freelance musician and composer. And I guess it's all about collaboration and as Alice said, in her, you know, listening as well to what people say and then helping create new musical environments.
Yeah, thank you, Andy, for telling us a bit about the piece and how your working practices have developed with the use of music technology. It's really interesting. So all it remains for me to do is to thank a few people. Thank you to Josh Savage for producing the podcast. And thank you to Arena and to Ellis, who've helped us today with setting up the equipment on their work experience. We're delighted that you're here. And thank you for listening. And of course, thank you to Alice Chesterman, our guest today. So if you've enjoyed this episode, please consider subscribing to our podcast, and the next conversation will be along very soon.